And at this time, I'm very pleased to welcome my esteemed colleague, David Bojan, who will be giving the introduction.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you for turning out, especially on this night. We really appreciate it. Well, I have followed the writing of Jennifer Gropps for over 20 years now, and I think it's safe to rank her as one of the most accomplished poets of her generation. She's the author of three collections, The Cusp, which won the prestigious Bakewell's First Book Prize and was issued by Houghton Mifflin in 2003, The Needle, which was published by Houghton Harcourt in 2011, and a forthcoming collection, The Window Left Open, which Grey Wolf Press will issue next year. Jennifer Gropps's poems range widely in their subject matter. While many concern the rural Texas of her youth, they travel to many other locales, Paris and Krakow especially, and they also visit the bland desolation that makes up so much of contemporary America's landscape. But her poems focus on many other things as well. A dizzying array of other subjects, from Caravaggio painting Medusa to a recording of the last castrati singer. What binds these poems together are several things. First of all, an acute fidelity to precision, both in image and in narrative content, the sort of precision that we encounter in the work of another traveler poet, Elizabeth Bishop. And as with Bishop, Gropps sees acuity and accuracy not as simple aesthetic goals, but moral ones. It's not merely that she sees a self-important voice and the easy linguistic tour de force as something for amateurs and tyros. It's that she understands, as Seamus Heaney once wrote, that clarity of description is in itself a form of revelation. And that stance gives her poems a quality that her former teacher Adam Zawiecki calls moral seriousness. And I should add that moral seriousness is a somewhat rare commodity among contemporary poets. Jennifer Gropps teaches at the University of Rochester, is also the assistant director of the Breadloaf Writers Conference. She's won a number of awards and honors for her work, has also been a prolific translator of the Polish and the French. I'm really pleased to welcome her to VCU tonight.
I'm super touched and grateful to be here. What David didn't say is one of the reasons he's been following my work is because I was a student for a long time. And it's really exciting to hear such lovely things being said, because I can remember when he wrote Purple next to as he should have. I mean, it was right. I'm delighted to be reading here, and I'm so impressed that how many people are here. I was also really charmed to see that the Book of Translations, which is my most recent publication, was the book that was featured for my reading. You know, not many schools would do that. And, you know, VCU does have, and Blackbird does have an interest in translation, which I really appreciate and grateful for. And in fact, Blackbird was one of the first places that I placed poems from that book, by Patrice Latour-Dupin, or Patrick Pintower, as I nickname him, and you can call him too. So I thought that I would actually begin with a couple of those poems, sort of in gratitude for that. All right, so I'm going to start with one called Psalm 22. In my sky there are stars invisible to the naked eye, and alone at night I name them. I arrange them. I give them names from a taxonomy invented for the great stars. My night sky hardly changes. The stars remain fixed while I move through time. I'm the one who determines which ones are good, which bad, like a judge who finds his own rulings final. By starlight, I can just begin to see the roaming bodies of the nocturnal creatures who first appear at dusk. Again, I say which are good, which are bothersome, just like a thinker who classifies himself among the innocent. And then abruptly, I have no choice but silence, as all my fauna, all my stars turn to smoke. Lord, the vocation of a poet is tragic, especially when he wants to make everything new for you. And when he uses your words to understand, whatever he makes sparkles for an instant and falls away. He sends out his spirit to the world, and his spirit does not come back. Like wind chasing clouds, his poems disappear. He remains face to face with the only question, why do this? And then life insists, saying, you will. But you, the Lord of life, is that what you say? Everything sways, the night stretches out. Is it you? One of the reasons I also thought I might start by reading a couple of these Patrick Pintower poems is he's, as you could hear there, he's clearly a poet who likes to write about writing poetry, or the quandary of writing poetry, which is a great tradition among religious writers, religious poets in particular. I'll read one more, but I know I have a lot of poets and writers in the room. This is Psalm 24. I've always felt something like a weight just beneath my awareness. Whenever I want to dance, I can feel it. It lowers me, not only toward the ground, but deep into an earth-sized secret where I have a field. How I love to lie down in this field, and myself in hiding, then disappearing into a night vaster than my own, sinking into it like a minuscule seed. Everything can start over, I tell the Lord, for there I speak to God in familiar terms. How to grow and how to increase can be relearned. The grace of your gravity presses me to discover. A secret heavier than my own weighs on me. It seeps out of my soul. I can't keep it. From utter darkness, a glimmering begins, the kind of glimmer your daylight will later contain. No one could count me among the visionaries. Nothing in this dimness allows itself to be seen. I make my poems the way an ash tree makes leaves. Not light, that's not for an ash tree to do. Before you take me back entirely, Lord, I ask you kindly, double light upon my leaves. All right, so that's our invocation. I wanted to read you some translations that I'm working on from the Polish by a poet I'm just crazy about named Jerzy Kwiatkowski, but I can't read a bunch of other people's work and not my own, I suppose. So I'll read now poems that are from my forthcoming book, Window Left Open. So this first one is called The Forest. During the day, I have watched them stand around and chew the yellow grass, the long-suffering cows. Sometimes steam comes from their nostrils. I have also visited them at night, seen an entire herd standing in the rain, as unreacting as the trees behind them when the jitter of flashlight warned of my approach. Those were the cows in the field by the forest, and those were the days when going outside felt like going inside. There was the sound of a woodpecker pecking, and that was a kind of knocking. And the sound of the pine trees creaking, and that was a kind of door. And so you could enter the forest, and although each moment you trespassed further became more tense, it only lasted until you could no longer see the road. Then you would be inside, on a kind of unending staircase of roots, worn silver like the soldered iron strips that hold stained glass together. From a distance, it would be mountains, but up close, under the arrows, spears, and ropes of trees, it was a forest floor, palatial leaf-meal mosaics on the ground. There was a little carpet of stream, so clogged with leaves it had stopped being a stream, and such a surfeit of silence it had become a kind of sound to which, for a while, you could pay attention. Though it's inaccurate, I want to say it was like staring at a light. All you could do was sense it. Then you had to recover, by which I mean to wait for everything to grow dim again. Then the mind was the only flashlight, a little bobbing beam that would illuminate randomly and too little. And this one's called Locked, and I steal my last lines I've stolen from Martin Buber. Just gonna say that. Locked. And yes, it is necessary to admit, walking in the forest, the heart is a lock. It has inviolable chambers, like the woods' fallen trees that block access to the river, snowdrops surprising its edges, moss crystalline with frost. What I thought I wanted, what I have tried to be, was the slender instrument that opened, a key, presence, moving deeper into the forest that releases the birds from the trees and sends them, ascends them, to sky by definition, open. But now there is nothing left to be solved like a riddle. This time the lock must be broken. What's left has to be seized, because God only loves the strong thief. I mean the man who breaks his heart for God. As David mentioned, I travel a lot in the summers because I'm lucky enough to have an academic life, but that's also when I write. So a lot of the sort of visual vocabulary, poetic vocabulary of my poems has come out of these travels. So I'm going to read a couple sort of Krakow-based poems. This one's called Watchmaker. Something in the rented apartment isn't working. The dying battery of an alarm I can't locate. No fire, just a piercing shrill every 5 minutes. Time is not working, and so sleepless, I'm existing in 5 minute increments. It is interesting. It is trying. I am trying not to notice, or rather to pay attention, as I once did entering the tiny watchmaker shop in Krakow, where every surface and wall was covered with something ticking. I could feel my blood pressure rise as I watched the watchmaker's calm, the precision with his tweezers, the keen gaze through his monocle. In Krakow, if a cat came up to me, I would speak to it in French sometimes by accident. The beep is a reset button. It makes my thinking start over, start on something new. Why is it hard to remember to speak to animals in their country's language? Once in France, I spoke to an impudent peacock in English, not because I forgot, but to cut through any pretense. No one ever speaks about how one's intimacy grows confused in different languages, even oneself, mildly at first, just briefly untethered. You split yourself into two languages, like the moment in a relationship when you start to keep a secret. Are you doing okay? Yes. This is called Self-Portrait on the Street of an Unnamed Foreign City. The lettering on the shop window in which you catch a glimpse of yourself is in Polish. Behind you, a man quickly walks by, nearly shouting into his cell phone. Then a woman, at a dreamier pace, carrying a just-bought bouquet upside down. All on a street where pickpockets abound, along with the ubiquitous smell of something baking. It is delicious to be anonymous on a foreign city street. Who knew this could be a life, having languages instead of relationships, struggling even then, finding out what it means to be a woman by watching the faces of men passing by. I went to distant cities. It almost didn't matter which, so primed was I to be reverent. All of them have the beautiful bridge crossing a gray, nearsighted river, one that massages the eyes, focuses the swooping birds that skim the water surface. The usual things I didn't pine for earlier because I didn't know I wouldn't have them. I spent so much time alone. When I actually turned lonely, it was vertigo. Myself estranged is how I understood the world. My ignorance had saved me. My vices fueled me. And then I turned 40. I, who loved to look and look, couldn't see what others did. Now I think about currencies, linguistic equivalents, how lopsided they are, while my reflection blurs in the shop windows. Wanting to be as far away as possible, exactly as much as still with you. Shamelessly entering a Starbucks, free Wi-Fi, to write this. Okay, I'm going to read the longest poem I'm going to read, but it's not that long, but it's long. And it's an ekphrastic, oh no. It describes a painting called A Boy with a Less Pleasant Book by Jean-Louis Clos. But you don't need to know it because I describe it ad nauseum. I'm just setting you up. It's called Edinburgh Meditation. The painting is by Greuze. It's titled A Boy with a Lesson Book. But at first glance, it's a girl, strawberry blonde with a lock of bangs pulled and knotted away from the pale brow, and the pair of small, perfect hands folded carefully over the tiny lesson book inadvertently causes tears because they're painted so exactly the viewer recognizes them, her little brothers. Now grown and now long passed away, like the boy in the painting. They belong to the short-lived, ungendered beauty of a child being solemn. The lesson book's lettering, too, is painted with such precision. She's certain she could read it if only she could climb atop some furniture and crook her head like a bird's, or if she could just will herself to be the boy. Both implausible, but in the quiet room of the museum on a winter morning, only barely so, in this thick dream of staring, the painting's so convincing that she could almost, in fact, she lingers a long time in that almost, but then she senses on her back the eyes of the museum guard in his tartan pants, and she's not one to make a scene. Later, walking the moors, the boy's face will come back to her. She will think of him while following footpaths through the fields, rolling hills, woods, along the River Esk, under stone bridges, alongside horses, and it will seem like she is walking in a painting, tiny villages perched in the distance, remote castles visible through late winter's bare branches. How she loves the moors. They go on forever. They go further than her legs can walk, her mind can think. They outlast her will. They outlast the daylight hours. Each time, she starts earlier, heads further, but the paths never end. She turns back when the sun gets low and makes the hay seem to blaze, burnishes the trees. Her steps, thousands of them, start to feel like thinkings accrual into knowledge, her eyes startled, hungrily observing details, then recognition, then familiarity from repeated walks, almost an ownership because by now she's memorized the moors. That's what the boy is doing in the painting. The look in his eyes is one of trying to remember something from the lesson book his little hands are covering. Verb conjugations, maybe, or vocabulary. It looks like sadness, but it's simpler. It's being lost. It's the boy running through the field of his own mind. The longer she looks, the more somber his eyes seem, and the flush in his left cheek is not from winter's chill after walking the moors, but emotion, and she begins to imagine him elsewhere, about to descend a staircase, and solemnly, absurdly announcing out loud, but to no one, "I regret the stairs." She's picturing him at home, where a polite visitor asks if he likes his new baby sister, and he shakes his head no and exclaims all she does is cry. When she looks at the painting, it helps her remember what it was like to clasp her little brother's hands, walk home with him from school. His fingernails always had a little rind of dirt underneath, and so did their baby cousins on the Oklahoma reservation. And why does she suddenly remember that, how the mother gently trimmed the baby's nails with her teeth? The woods are such a riot of branches, and the leaves that fell in autumn are still on the ground, blanched by decomposition's lace-making, and horseshoes emboss the muddy parts of the path. Etiolated grasses, spray of ferns, and in the wet, shadowy spots, moss flourishes so that green is practically a form of light. And if she stays late on the path, she also sees the sky's more sublime version of a screensaver blue. The silence of such places is so complete, it sinks into one's mind in waves, drenching it with some life-giving essence, Edwin Meir once wrote, not the mere absence of sound. In that silence, the moor is a living thing, spreading its fleece of purple and brown and green to the sun. That's when she feels like she's walking inside a painting, when it's either a secret her every step helps discover or else a practice of memory she can't even tell. All she knows is that she loves the boy's trance of concentration, that momentary withdrawal where he listens to an inner whisper, where his eyes perform that gesture impossible to describe, but recognized by a viewer of being open but not seeing, emptying themselves so as to hear. Her neck begins to ache because she's got it tilted, like Leonardo's Madonna in the next room. She's been standing there gazing dreamily, so still, that she has a quick sensation of being the painting and the boy being the world, the frame being the window through which he could study her also, if only he would finish his memorization, if only he would raise his head up and look out. Wouldn't he see? She wants something she has no language for. She doesn't want the language, she wants the something. Okay, I'm gonna switch to some of what I think of as the monastery poems. And those are sort of the, I guess the center of this next book. For the past like 5 or 6 summers, I have, I always feel like an eccentric when I say this, that I've gone and stayed in a rural monastery in the French Alps, a former Franciscan monastery that is now open to writers. And it's extremely rural. There's almost no electricity. There's no technology. There's gardens that the monks carved into the mountains that are sort of like a staircase and orchards. It's really beautiful. And it's been a good place for me to go for lots of reasons. And it's become a sort of character in this next book. So here's one called Scorpion. When it's warm, you'll see one every day, Isabel warns newcomers to the monastery. And so I check my shoes, the bed, the pillow, until I find one. And the first scorpion was innocuous, already dead, curled in the shower drain like a tuft of pubic hair. The second, a closer call, balanced on the upturned base of an espresso cup just washed. Then a false alarm when an earwig crawled from the center of a rose. There are roses everywhere this time of year. It is natural for the village women to collect downy piles into bowls, then to press the petals like fingerprints into framed screens of fat, so that when the roses are all gone, there will still be the smell of rose petals. There will be the utterly pure because thoroughly disembodied essence of rose, persisting in the form of oil, which you may transfer to your own body, rub and spread into thinner layers until the skin absorbs the oil but leaves the short-lived essence of rose. Now I've gone all day without one and am afraid, not for having found a scorpion, but from its very absence. All of the scorpions purified into essence of scorpion, not a perfume, but a fear. What amount of fear is the right amount of fear? I want to find the correct proportion, but my only measure is analogy, to ponder how this is like that. Sometimes I can see there is no answer because I am not asking the question right, but God, I am doing the best I know how. I'm going to give you the two-poem warning now. You know about that? It means you only have to wait two more poems to find out what the score is. All right, so this poem is called Apricots. Apricots. I judged them very carefully, as though I'd been given the charge to determine which are good or bad. And they were all good. Even the slightly overripe ones with bruises had a bitter ferment that only brightened the scent. And the two young ones, firm and slightly sour, not yet softened by the sun. And the ripe ones that felt like biting into my own flesh, slightly carnivorous. They had been elegant in the tree, tiny coquettes blushing more and more until I picked them. Then they were minimalist and matte colored in wooden bowls, so barely furred one couldn't help but clothe them, enclose them with your hand, caress each one thoroughly before taking a bite, exploring the handsome freckles left from some minor blight. Now I stand under the tree and pluck them one after the other. Each one tastes different, like a mind having erratic thoughts. Going into the trance, halfway between eating and thinking, the thought of an apricot, the apricot of a thought, whose goodness occurs over time, so that some had been better earlier, others soon would become correct, I mean ripe. You know what? I just learned something. I realized reading those opening lines, I've been given the charge to determine which are good or bad. I totally stole that from Patrice Nigel Dupin, from translating him, which is awesome because, you know, I actually think, no, I'm excited about it. This is not enough poets translate. And, you know, before the workshop, this is how poets assumed craft. The workshop is a pretty recent invention. You really do learn a lot. At least you learn how to stretch, widen the aperture of what you already do. All right, so this is my last poem. And thank you again for your really kind listening under the circumstances. So this is called Poppies. There is a sadness everywhere present, but impossible to point to. A sadness that hides in the world and lingers. You look for it because it is everywhere. When you give up, it haunts your dreams with black pepper and blood, and when you wake, you don't know where you are. But then you see the poppies, a disheveled stand of them, and the sun shining down like God, loving all of us equally, mountain and valley, plant, animal, human, and therefore shouldn't we love all things equally back? And then you see the clouds. The poppies are wild. They are only beautiful and tall so long as you do not cut them. They are like the feral cat who purrs and rubs against your leg, but will scratch you if you touch back. Love is letting the world be half-tamed. That's how the rain comes, softly and attentively, then with unstoppable force. If you stare upwards as it falls, you will see they are falling sparks that light nothing only because the ground interrupts them. You can hear the way they burn, the smoldering sound they make, falling into the grass. That is a sound for the sadness everywhere present. The closest you have come to seeing it is at night, with the window open and the lamp on, when the moths perch on the white walls, tiny as a fingernail, too large as a Gerber daisy, and take turns agitating around the light. If you grasp one by the wing, its pill-sized body will convulse in your closed palm, and you can feel the wing beats like an eyelid's obsessive blinking open to see. But now it is still light, and the blackbirds are singing like their voices are the only scissors left in this world. Thank you.
Jennifer's happy to A, sign books, and also follow our tradition of, you know, answering a few questions if you have them.
I'm going to field the
yep.
questions.
Yes.
You didn't have a question, I was going to make you have a question.
I got it.
This is in your wheelhouse.
Got it, yo. What is a poet's relationship to money?
They're allergic to it. No, but is that what you're asking? What is a poet's relationship to money, or what is money?
What is money's
language as currency?
Yeah, language is. What is a poet's relationship to money, and as a poet has to relate to language, and language is this exchange.
I'm being a little coy by saying poets are allergic to it, but they really are. I mean, I
have a more accurate.
Okay.
Question. Is it like?
I hear you.
The language of expression isn't necessarily a trade. Like, it's not necessarily keeping an account. Like, if you're weaving, like, a rug, it's different than having an account of who owes you what.
Well, I disagree. I think language is a kind of record keeping, and I think poetry, and, I mean, now that I'm getting older, like, the poems accrue, I start to see, I don't know what you would think about this, Dave, if you would agree, but I think part of poetry, it measures how one passes through time. And that seems actually really crucial. In fact, I think it does a better job of it than anything else. But I agree that your observation is, I mean, it's dead on, it's really astute in the sense, I mean, I know I have that line in there about thinking about currencies and languages and linguistic equivalents and how lopsided they are, and they really are, that, you know, the Tower of Babel of human experience is quite troubling. Like, somehow, the record-keeping, you know, the accounting never adds up. And there's always, somehow we're always cut short, or lost, you know, we somehow lost something. And I think that poem is definitely kind of figuring that out while walking around the city, sort of thing.
Cool.
But I can't say anything more philosophical about that, probably.
How do you know when a poem is finished?
Well, as my former teacher, David Wojcik, used to quote Valérie, that, you know, poems aren't finished, they're just abandoned. I think that's true, but I think to go back to that notion of, you know, a poem recording where one is, you know, moving through time. I think for me, it's like there's a period of time when a poem is very malleable and I can say it or I can make it better or radical things can happen. And then like a window closes, something happens and then it's calcified enough that I can just tinker. I can't radically, maybe that experience will change. Maybe I'll have some experience that will make me realize that no, a poem you can go back to it and radically change it. But for me, they're finished because I become a different person than the person who wrote them. And then I become more interested, not in fixing it, even if it's flawed, but more interested in what writing the next poem, my next brilliant poem is going to solve the problem that I didn't solve in the last one. I don't know. These are hard questions.
I know you're very very interested in Poland, and a lot of your work explores things there, and you know, Zajewski, and how do you feel things have changed since the end of communism? I mean, Polish poetry was so vital. There were so many great Polish poets that you're very familiar with before the fall of communism. Do you still feel that there's a real vitality in the Polish poetry scene?
Well, great poets even after the fall of communism. But yeah, I mean, what you're describing is really true. I mean, people often assume that I'm Polish, that Grotz is a Polish name, but it's not. It's German. I just fell in love with Polish poetry, which thankfully is very well translated into English, and became so interested in it that I started studying Polish to read it in the original. And I also, Adam Zagajewski was my teacher in my PhD program, and he asked me to help organize a poetry seminar in Krakow because I had a lot of arts administration experience. So I kind of found myself in this perfect place to assume Polish poetry, which has had a huge effect on American poetry, as you know. And in particular, you know, the great five of, I would say, you know, Miłosz, Herbert, Szymborska, Różewicz, who's the least known, Tadeusz Różewicz, and Adam Zajewski, who's the youngest. And they're very well translated into English, and we've made a real narrative about what they have done for Polish poetry. And it's valid, and I think that's some of the greatest poetry that was written in the 20th century, hands down. I mean, that poetry will never become unimportant or insignificant. But it's interesting, you know, spending as much time, you know, Poland has changed a great deal since, I mean, I only went way after the fall of communism. I mean, I was in high school, I guess, during the fall of communism. I went for the first time, I think, in 2002 or one, I can't remember. So a long time ago, but not, you know, later.
Yeah.
But even in that decade or decade and a half, Poland has changed radically. I mean, I do think I got to see a sense of what it was like before the fall. And it is true that it becomes more and more Americanized every year. And there's a real crisis in Polish poetry that I watch from afar with a lot of fascination, because I think it's kind of like the way American poetry may have been after T.S. Eliot. I think the young Polish poets feel the need to sort of reject these master, you know, these to reject Miwa, you know, these poets. How do you rise? I mean, talk about the anxiety of influence. Like, how do you rise up while like McDonald's is suddenly there? Like, how do you like get the traction to like write about the Warsaw Ghetto? And so it's a partly to where what you inherit. You know, as Helen Vindler says about poets, it's half what you're, you know, given and half what you make of it. And what's really fascinating to me is that young Polish poets have been deeply influenced by the New York School poets in particular. So, you know, Ashbery, O'Hara, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, the guy that I co-translate Jerzy Futowski with is, you know, the most famous translator of Ashbery into Polish. And when I look at Ashbery in Polish, it's actually a little clearer because he's sort of interpreted, he's made choices for me that, and the levels of diction, I don't register the nuances of the diction, I think that. What the young Polish poets really get from us is this permission not to carry the mantle of history, like not to, have to address the Holocaust and to be able to use the first person and to be able to be funny, to be playful and ludic. And so, for me, I feel so lucky. It feels kind of random and accidental that I became so invested in Polish poetry. But I feel like it was a really exciting moment for that to happen. I mean, I hope someday that I can figure out how to write about this. But, you know, this late 20th century moment where both poetries, both American and Polish poetries, had something to say to each, had like an antidote for each other's problems. Mm-hmm. Because I think Polish poetry, the reason we partly love Polish poetry or that narrative of those big five is that we feel so useless as poets in the United States. We don't know how to write an ambitious poem, a poem that takes on history, or, you know, we feel like we need to apologize or be ironic, or we don't give ourselves permission for anything, you know, to do anything. And so, I think the two poetries have helped each other, and I don't know what will happen in the long run, but. Any others?
Interested in your process of translation. You don't have a co-translator in French, do you?
No.
Directly?
No. No, my French is really good. I mean, I studied French for a long time. It was I lived in Paris for a while. I studied there. And Polish I've also studied for over a decade, but it's a freaking hard language. And I just don't feel, poetry, you just have to know, you have to really be, figure out the nuances. And so I co-translate with Polish, which is really enjoyable. It's actually a very fun experience because writing and translating is usually a pretty lonely process, so it's quite fun.
How did you end up at the monastery, and why a monastery, and what was that like the first couple days?
I went to the south of France. I went to the Camargo Foundation, which is a study center in the south of France that hosts scholars and writers and artists and composers. And I was lucky enough to go there several years ago. And it's actually where I wrote a good deal of The Needle, my last book of poetry. And I just fell in love with the south of France. I've never been anywhere really but Paris when I was a student. And when I left, I was so in love with it that when I left, I was like, I have to find a way to come back. And so a French friend had told me about this monastery, and the last Franciscan had died. It's a medieval monastery and very rural and literally on a mountaintop. But when the last Franciscan had died, like in the 80s or something, the French government took the monastery over. It became French patrimoine, as they call it. And they couldn't figure out what to do with it because they couldn't really turn it into a hotel because of architectural things. There's only like two bathrooms in the entire monastery. And these cells, like the monk cells, are tiny, but they all are painted with frescoes. And so anyhow, they decided that writers would probably like that. And so they opened it to writers. And you don't have to be French to apply. I mean, if you speak French, you have to apply in French. They don't monitor you, like what you do. I mean, I've worked on all different kinds of things when I'm there. But it is so rural, you really have to speak French or you'll be in trouble. But so I went the first time and I really freaked out. I couldn't believe how beautiful the place was. And I also didn't know that places like that in the world existed really still. I know that they do, but I hadn't seen them, especially in Europe. And, the first day or two, you're kind of like, oh my God, I have to check my email. Like, oh my God. And there's one internet connection in the village. And one of the things that really charmed the first year was going down to the village to like addictively, delete my spam. And they're like, the person in line like was like a shepherd who was wanting to check weather.com. I just love, so like it's, we don't need tech. We don't need things, and we're so chained to the tech. So for me, what was so useful, after you get over that, withdrawal, it's like addiction, then the world, I've spent some of the happiest days of my life there, just being in the sensual world. It's like it gave me back this kind of version of the earth that, I just got to look at things. And, I hiked in the Alps in the morning. I wrote all day, and then in the afternoon, they have these orchards, the gardens, and I know it sounds weird, but I would walk and kind of like read the garden because every day it changed a little bit. So, and the days are so long. I go in the summer, and the days there are so long. So, it just felt like the richest experience of one of the richest experiences I've ever had. Even though I was living in complete poverty, I was digging up potatoes. And what I didn't say before the apricots poem was that the last time I went there, I was robbed at the Nice train station on my way to the monastery, and I didn't realize it until I had gotten on the train to go there, which was also very rural. And it's a long story, but I was stuck in a very rural place and couldn't call to cancel my credit cards, much less get access to money. And it became clear I had to live the whole month penniless. And there was no ATM machines in the village or anything like that. And I really, really sunk. I was really depressed because I just felt really helpless in this strange way I'd never had before. But I lived off the garden. And, you know, that apricots poem was just me, you know, picking my breakfast one morning. You know, like I ate a lot of fruit. And I survived just fine, you know. So, I don't know, I really love that place. It's kind of surreal. And when I first started writing poems, you know, showing people poems from that place, they were, you know, one of my friends was calling them psychedelic. But they're not. I mean, I'm just literally describing as calmly as possible our earth, which we're lucky to have.
Yeah, and here in the selection that you chose tonight, the first one, if you talk about the time on the mountain, brings out a little bit of a terror kind of thing in your voice. In terms of the scorpion. And then when you go to the apricots, it's the sensual nature. So you've got these two different fields going on in your poetry. And then it seems to underlie that is theology. Can you comment upon that?
Yeah, I actually kind of feel, I mean, not to make myself sound all highfalutin, but I feel like a lot of these poems are like the songs of innocence and the songs of experience. I've written the most ecstatic poems I've ever written in my life in this book, and I've also written the darkest by far, which I didn't read any of those tonight. But one thing about being in that environment that I'm describing is when you fall, nothing stops you. You know, there's not the Simpsons will be on at 7, like there's nothing to like stop you from and to save you from yourself. But on the other hand, there's also nothing to stop the high, you know, the ecstasy. Mm-hmm. And Poppies, the poem that I closed with, was actually the first poem I wrote there. But the apricots I feel secretly kind of proud about, because who knew, like, out of my, like, despair that I would figure out how, or my fear, like, how I would figure out how to write a poem of praise. Like, you know, the poem itself ended up doing something, and I don't know if you feel this way if you write poems too, that sometimes your poems can reach a place before you can. And like looking back on it, I think, well, you would never know. That's why I didn't decide to tell that pattern, because I thought, well, that's a buzzkill for the poem. But that's how it happened.
Well, thanks again, Jennifer.
Thank you for your question.